Okay, move out.
You're listening to the Valor Podcast, a show that highlights the men and women who defend the United States of America and the people who support them.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
Hello and welcome to the Valor Podcast. I am Nick Lehman. One of the most important assets on the battlefield is a medic. Back in the day, the combat medic did not carry a weapon. We'll talk about how that has evolved over time and the modern day advancements of medical miracles, if you will. More on that in a minute. First, I want to thank the Hershey Miyamura Korean War Chapter for sponsoring this show. They are based in central New Mexico. They are a great bunch of patriots and veterans who have helped the Valor Podcast. If you know a Korean War veteran, talk to them about joining a local chapter in their state or city. There's many Korean War chapters across this great land, and I think it would be a great thing to get Grandpa or Dad out to the hall and have them talk with their buddies that they served with. We are speaking with Judd Dean. He attended West Point. He served in the U.S. Army in the Medical Service Corps as an officer and did a combat deployment to Bosnia. He currently is a Vice President of Clinical Operations for ABQ Health Partners in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Judd, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me, man.
Yeah, so I joke with my wife, and not really joke, but kind of like dead serious, but a joke, that if anything catastrophic happened to me in the street or anywhere in the world, the first person I want on my side is a combat medic. That's a testament of how confident I am to save lives. How important is a combat medic to the battlefield and life?
Oh man, I could go on and on about that. I think, I had the fortunate privilege of leading combat medics in a Bosnia rotation, and I will tell you, they're very important in the garrison setting. Back at post here in America, they are just so integral on a battlefield, and I watched how soldiers responded to going out the gate and needing their medic to go with them. And all of a sudden, this platoon that I had the privilege of leading, we became really important. Not that we weren't on post, but we were really important. And as you kind of alluded to, the soldiers are really good. You would want them to be there to save you. Not only their skills, because they are highly trained and continually trained, but their bravery, and their willingness to go forward if there's landmines or snipers or whatever. That's a group of people that stuff doesn't scare, and it is pretty neat to be associated with them.
It's so you can talk a little bit about the going into the training of it. I mean, this is like, modern medicine on a dirty field. I mean, there's dirt, there's dust, there's shrapnel, there's all kinds of elements, and you have to stabilize that patient, whether it's an enemy, whether it's an actual brother or sister in arms, or even a civilian. I mean, there's a lot of things that go into saving a life in theater, if you will.
Yeah, it's very true. So the training that a combat medic gets is just multiple facets to it. There's the certainly the medical training you would expect, like the EMT paramedic type training, which is just ongoing and continual, as it should be. There's also assessing the battlefield and being the situational commander and kind of generally sorting through the chaos. If there's a reason for combat medics, there's often chaos around that. And all of the all of the folks on the battlefield could be taken care of. And there's a very basic triage that's the same triage used in an ER down the road is the triage used in the on the battlefield. And there are times where a soldier, an American soldier, might not be treated first if there's a non-combatant civilian who is more injured, right? Life, limb, or eyesight. And so that's also ingrained in the medics, yeah.
Tell me a little bit about the history of a, you know, I'm sure you were indoctrinated with all kinds of history of the combat medic. I mean, back in the day in the Revolution and Civil War, I mean, it was just a guy that had a pouch, and now it's evolved to, you know, a guy that and girl that actually carries a bag full of tools and a weapon.
Yep. Yeah. That is correct. The medics I deployed with carried weapons. Fortunately, never really had to use them, because there were others around that could use them. So it has evolved greatly. The modern day combat medic is incredibly sophisticated. Some people may not know, but a lot of advancements in medicine in general happened on the battlefields. For example, in the Civil War and in the different world wars, where doctors and medical personnel were basically given an opportunity to try drastic things like cutting off limbs or tourniquets or things like that, and just really advancing that science. It happened on the battlefield because it was a great place to do it. It we need to save a life, and anybody got any great ideas? Let's try it. It has evolved. The Geneva Convention still oversees, the rules that a combat medic lives by on the battlefield. So once the combat medic starts shooting their weapon, they are considered combatants at that point. If the combat medic has the Red Cross on and is distinguished, then they fall under the Geneva Convention of Protection. Realistically, I'll say, at least when I was in the military in the late 90s, early 2000s, we didn't have a lot of appreciation that our enemies respected the Geneva Convention. So it kind of made more sense for the medics to carry the weapons versus not have them and try to invoke that convention that seemed nobody was really listening to.
Right. I mean, warfare has changed over the last a couple centuries. I mean, there was like the gentleman's agreements, like, okay, that's your medic, that's your chaplain, we'll leave them alone. But now it's like, we don't care. We hate you, and we're gonna kill you, or you're the target. And
yeah, and that's following the rules and going against people that aren't following the rules, it's a hard place to be. So we ended up being a little more on the aggressive side of the interpretation of that. And my understanding in the much heavier fought wars in Iraq and Afghanistan more recently, that was also the case. That medics went in with their weapons, and I think that's the right answer.
Oh yeah, I mean you're a soldier, or a warrior. You always have to be prepared. I mean, you don't know what's coming around the corner,
yeah,
and all that. What are some things that are trained? You have basic training, but when you go off to the MOS school, what are some things that are just drilled into a combat medic?
So a combat medic's bread and butter is probably kind of starts with an IV, right? Being able to put a needle in somebody and get the vein versus not getting the vein. I recall that being a pretty heavy part of the training of the soldiers. So that skill and being able to do that was not always easy. But then all kinds of The advanced medical training for the soldiers right out of basic training was all about tourniquets, field wounds, bandages. For me as the officer, as the medical platoon leader, it was about calling in the 9-line medevac and bringing the helicopters in, and where is the LZ and marking it appropriately, and reading the map was a big part of my world, and making sure I knew where we were so we could always extract if we needed to. and just all the kind of protocols that go with carrying out the healthcare on a battlefield, all echelons of healthcare. I was, as a combat medic and medical platoon leader, I was on echelon one, which is, you know, right there at the ground level. By the time I left the military as a company commander, I was in echelon three. I got to command a company in the 10th Combat Support Hospital out of Fort Carson, and that was the hospital where, when I was in Bosnia, in fact, it was the exact same hospital, when I was in Bosnia, we would extract, you know, we'd medevac back to that hospital. And so I got to see those two echelons of care. And then in the hospital setting, just a pretty different skill set. So we have ICU, intensive care, the ER sort of setting. There was X-ray, pharmacy, all
rehab.
That. Rehab, yeah. There was everything you could think was put in tents and all the skill set that goes into it. We actually had cooks. We had people that ran the water and the electricity, kind of tech sort of folks. All of them, you know, soldiers in the Army. And that's a whole different, you know, sort of skill set and different sort of MOSs and specialties versus the combat medic on the first echelon.
It's very fascinating to, you know, I read books and watch documentaries and things like that. And everybody, you know, is like, you know, the combat medic is important to our mission and our everything like that. But there's some nuances to it. There's some simple things that help troop welfare, like, you know, change your socks and other things. Were there kind of things in Bosnia that you just kind of take back here and you're telling your kids, hey, change your socks?
Yeah, you know, realistically, my wife is way better at the cleanliness of my children and their sanitation, I suppose. But yeah, in terms of, like, it's an interesting question, like skills learned in the military that I use here. I actually still in my truck today, I have a... it's kind of like a survival kit with MREs, meals ready to eat, and water, you know, because in the military, it's just ingrained into you, never go without water. And so I have just like some basic rations in my vehicle. And in terms of the kit expectations, I'm not sure any of the military training has been invoked in my children, other than it's probably fair to say just discipline in general is present in the household, both by myself and my wife. Yeah, another, you mentioned Bosnia and the cleanliness of socks. That's true. I did a summer rotation there. And for those that don't know, Bosnia is a lot like West Virginia in many ways. It's really cold in the winter, really hot in the summer, real humid. And quite a few people were getting prickly heat. I remember that. And that's just from not cleaning not changing their shirts, their undershirts often enough. And really what it is it's just sweating too much. You know, it's just really super hot. And we were in these up-armored Humvees, which means they were a lot of landmines around Bosnia. And they were meant to be able to go through a landmine. That's the good news, right? You want that when you're out in Bosnia. The bad news that you don't get told is that the heaviness of those Humvees means that the air conditioner gets totally overwhelmed. And I don't think there was a single Humvee on our post that had a working air conditioner. And so we were in these just hot boxes in all of our Kevlar, all of our battle gear. The windows in these Humvees would only go down like half an inch, and they were about 3 inches thick of like plexiglass type stuff. And so it just, you're sweating all day, every day. And so it's almost impossible not to get the prickly heat, but we had to be real careful about that. And there's a little bit of irony in it, because when I showed up to West Point, for basic training, it was the same thing. It was like this randomly hot summer at West Point in 1993. And there's really no air conditioning there because it's more of a winter sort of place. So a lot of heat, but not a lot of air conditioning. And yeah, it's prickly heat again. So I have these, like, some of my toughest memories in the military are associated with prickly heat.
That's awesome. And, you know, you mentioned that you were in Bosnia and you were there for, you know, a tour and all that. It seems like the medical professionals there are sort of like the ambassadors to these people that, you know, as the outsiders or the civilians living in that town might seem as occupiers, but you guys are actually bringing a goodwill and you know, medical clinics and things like that.
Yeah, we did medical fairs. We had, in fact, we had at one point, actually the entire time, we had a special forces medic embedded with us as well. We had doctors, PAs, and even a dentist was stationed with us in Bosnia. And we did a couple health fair type things where like teeth were extracted and moles removed, stuff like that. So yeah, there is a bit of goodwill to the community. What you touch on, though, I think is so important to say about the combat medics in general is, you know, that group of human beings has chosen to enter into a dangerous profession, even more dangerous than average because they're in the military, and yet they're doing, you know, their role is to help. And I found that the humans attracted to that, the young men I got to serve with, and then ladies when I was a company commander, they really just want to help people. And they not only are they willing to help people, they're willing to die to help people, and that is, you know, not every human can say that, and so to be able to be a part of that kind of group that has that sort of mindset, and then to be able to lead that kind of group with that kind of mindset, it's a real gift. You know, I was so privileged to be able to do that. These are great human beings.
There has to be some sort of, you know, a special person has to do it, like you said, but there's also that adrenaline rush factor to it because no situation or thing is going to be the same. I mean, obviously dehydration, throw an IV in, get them back. But I mean, we're dealing with combat kind of circumstances, landmines, gunshot wounds, you name
yeah.
it.
Yeah, there's an adrenaline junkie side to some of them. I would say, and this might be interesting, that maybe less than you might think. Like I found the combat medics tended to be a little more almost academic than the average soldier, a little more scholarly than the average soldier, maybe a little bit more curiosity to how things work than the average soldier. And so, you know, they're kind of an interesting group of folks. Yes, some are adrenaline junkies and some were introverts, you know, and some just had a deep desire to help and it's almost kind of fun to think of. I've got like a picture playing in my head of some of my troops and just, you know, how shy some of these young little 18, 19 year olds were, but my goodness, how effective they were and how tough they could get and how maybe tough they didn't seem when not called to action, but when called to action, it's like, wow, look at this guy go, you know, pretty cool to see.
Yeah. He or she saved that soldier or other civilians or anything like that. Or is there any particular mission that you remember while you were deployed out that you saw a team of medics and other people just work together to save somebody? Or
yeah, kind of an interesting and funny one. And I'm going to give this as a testament to my troops, and they're quite a few things happened in Bosnia, but I just say again, it was not the combat that a lot of folks saw in the World War IIs or Afghanistan's or Iraq's more recently. It was certainly more of a peacekeeping mission, but we did have issues and we had to deal with them. There was one time, and we had trained multiple times. As the platoon leader, I got to kind of lead the training of the folks along with the platoon sergeant, and so we actually had a slogan called "No Regrets," where we started talking about this as we were training up before going to Bosnia, and the idea was, let's have no regrets when we come back, right? So nobody died on my hand in my watch. Blood wasn't shed that I couldn't take care of. I did everything I could prepping so that when I was needed, I had no regrets. And so that was kind of our slogan. And there was one time kind of towards the end, we'd done a few trainings, certainly leading up, you know, Fort Carson leading up to going to Bosnia. But then when we were in Bosnia, we did some trainings as well. And so one day, randomly in the middle of the day, we had a soldier, a private, I believe, who actually passed out behind the wheel and had three other soldiers in the Humvee. And they ran smack dab into the back of a a dump truck that was full of sand, and the dump truck was kind of lifted, and so it hit the window of the Humvee, and just really kind of a bad place for an accident. I happen to be actually in the restroom when the call comes in. It's incredibly frantic. I hear the radios going nuts. And literally by the time I can get out, some of my soldiers are already out of the post. Totally did it kind of without me. It was like that moment of glory that I could really help out, and they totally did it without me. Went, got the troop. In fact, we ended up medevacing him back, and he ended up in Landstuhl, Germany. He had a heart condition, of all things, and that's what caused him to pass out in the severe heat. And so I remember going, wow, I'm really happy that all this training has paid off. And what I was supposed to do, I didn't even really have to, because others could fill in. And that was a big part of training in the battlefield, is to always have kind of a plan B and somebody else that can handle it. And we really didn't have just another person that could handle a situation in a crisis like this. We had like almost 30 of them. We were all kind of highly trained to be ready to take whatever leadership position we needed. And so there it was. I kind of took myself out of a job by the heavy training.
Hey, that's a great story, and showing the leadership of leaders within the military. Training. The thing that as a civilian, it hits me, but I know it hits a lot more veterans and people that serve, is that they call the medic doc.
Mm-hmm.
And it sends chills down my spine, because it's like, you guys aren't, you know, officially doctors.
Correct.
But you guys have done amazing things out there through the generations that have saved people's lives.
Yeah, that's quite a term of endearment to the medics, and it's in my way I heard it and saw it in action, is it was meant out of complete respect. You know, doctors have quite high regard in our society, and honestly, those medics, the combat medics, I remember they would just get so embedded in with the platoons and the companies that they supported, that if I had to, for whatever reason, kind of make a switch, literally, I was getting calls as a lieutenant. I was getting calls from captains saying, "Hey, why are you taking my doc away from me?" And it really, I think some of it was even in the psyche of the troops that we supported, is like, there's almost a good luck charm to it. There's like, this is my, this is a person that I am so endeared to. I'm not going out of the gate without him with me, because I know he'll be there to save me and save my life. And I think that's the term of endearment that Doc represents. And I think it's a real honor. And we had a doctor in Bosnia, and I mentioned a couple PAs.
They were called Mr. Not just
yeah, they were also called Doctor.
Yeah.
Actually, or Captain. They were both captains. The doc and the dentist were captains.
Yeah, so definitely. And the reason that we're having kind of this episode is the importance of, you know, medical care on the battlefield, but also the recent story of Hacksaw Ridge. I've known about it for a couple of years now, mm-hmm. and it's quite a story with Desmond Doss and what he did in that, you know, 10-day stretch of saving men.
Mm-hmm.
Was that legend in your schooling and things like that?
I definitely knew the story as well, fair to say. In fact, there's another kind of inside fun story. Is at one point when we were training for Bosnia, and we were doing a field exercise out in the winter of Fort Carson, which Fort Carson's outside of Colorado Springs, so it can be pretty cold being in a tent. And at one point, I got a book of combat medics, and it was just a chapter on every combat medic who'd won the Medal of Honor, and there were a lot of them, and there still are. At one point, at least, there were more combat medics with Medal of Honors than anyone else. I don't know if 100% that's true today. And I would, every night, I read a nighttime story to my troops, and I read them about one of the combat medics who won the Medal of Honor. It certainly is a legacy that medics, and I presume today, certainly when I served, they're aware of, that being a part of combat medic, being a combat medic is special. And there have been many that have gone before us that have earned such high regard. And so, yeah, I can't say we use the DOS story a ton, but just the likeliness to it, we used. And in my aid station at Fort Carson, we had painted a combat medic basically taking care of a soldier. So it was kind of an inspirational sort of painting. And then above it, we had the Shakespeare quote, "For he today who sheds his life with me shall be my brother." And so there's a lot of camaraderie around the specialness, if that's a word, of what we got to do. And it was never really forgotten that there's a calling in a way to it. And so, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think they even have like a course named after him somewhere. There's some camp. Yeah, it's like the DOS course or something like that. So,
yeah, I'm not aware of that, but that wouldn't surprise me. There's a lot of that in the military. Yeah.
Oh yeah, definitely. And so the, like you said, he was one of the many that earned the Medal of Honor, the highest award that our nation can give to military members, and. It's just a remarkable story because, one, he was a conscientious objector. He said, mm-hmm. You know what? I'm not for the war, but I'm going to help the common cause of America. Mm-hmm. How important is that today in our current climate? You know, you see tons of different sides of the story.
Yeah, I almost, you know, my initial reaction is I almost love to see more of that, you know. It feels that our nation and maybe it's even our world is pretty polarized and divided. And in reality, as I reflect, it was in World War II as well. It was in the Civil War. I mean, there's not been a lot of time in I'm not sure when the time is that the world was in complete harmony. You know, it's just kind of a reality of where
Eden.
We find. Yeah, maybe Eden. There. That's just not the world I've lived in, and it is a reality. And to have people who, you know, navigate that world with all the same stressors, all the same polarization, yet have a lens that they look through that just has a little more positivity or a little more reconciliation or collaboration. That feels like a good place to be, you know, and it's guys like Doss that just kind of had a different perspective and they became pretty special.
And so, you know, this whole world is changing. There's all kinds of different threats. I'm not, you know, I'm aware of threats. I'm not the type of guy that's paranoid, like, oh my gosh, we can't go out. We got all this. But what are some things that people can, you know, kind of prepare themselves to be ready for, a situation in terms of medical care and things? You know, things happen in public.
Yeah. Oh, that's a good question. In a lot of ways, I think you can almost never be overprepared. You know, you mentioned like water safety, you know, just drinking water and sunscreen, just the basics, blocking and tackling. But yeah, I mean, the reality is that sometimes there's more than that needed. It can be a dangerous world, and there's more people doing bad things, it seems, or at least we publicize them more. I'm not sure what the right answer is, but yeah, I'll tell you, when I think of that question, I think of, you know, my role as a father and as a husband. I have children and a wife, and I feel that, you know, there could be a moment where I have to step in and protect. You know, I don't take that lightly. And I kind of look back on my military background and think, I'm thankful I have that. And I think I'd be able to do the right thing when needed. And there's a lot of people that train that. There's a lot of money spent on training people to be ready for that sort of situation. But it is a dangerous place for sure.
What are some things that people could keep in their trunk or their back of the rig or things that can, you know, really critically save a life and give the person that's arriving, taking them to the hospital, more preparation.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm going to start with the basic staple of water. A human can go almost a month without eating, somewhere in that range, but only a few days without water. And so I think that's critical to have. Blanket if it gets cold. I always think of what happens if I'm stranded, when it's in a snowstorm. Right, which is not uncommon. In fact, that happens, it seems, every year. Somebody gets stranded or dies, and so or gets stranded and lives, and that's a great story too. Heat, matches. I keep matches as well. I actually happened to be able to go to survival escape resistance school, SERI school, when I was in the military. And one thing they taught us was just don't give up, right? So just get creative. If you're in a vehicle, don't leave your vehicle. You've got great heat protection in that vehicle, right?
You got all kinds of wires too to make anything.
Yeah, you can make all kinds of stuff. You can burn the tires. There's just a lot of things you can do. And mostly don't lose your mind. Don't lose your facility and that willingness to fight to live. So I pretty simple: water, blanket. I like to keep a chain just in case, to help tow me out. I happen to drive a truck, so I have a lot of room to keep stuff, as you might think. Basic tools. I think, even just having the basics is pretty helpful.
And what should people learn about in terms of first aid? And, like I said, cars are going faster. Cars are, doing great things. But also there's also situations, with domestic violence and terrorist acts where there's gunshot wounds. There's other types of things. What are some critical things that a person can do if they're first on scene?
Yeah, I mean, it's some of the basic tenets. It's kind of the triage, life, limb, or eyesight. Go to the place where you're needed most. Go to the patient that needs you the most. Then you do the ABCs. You look at airway, blood circulation. Airway, breathing, circulation, and I'm probably even getting that wrong. It's been a while. But basically, if they're not breathing, they're not going to live very long. So you got to fix that first. So CPR. Knowing CPR, keeping oxygen in a vehicle may or may not be a wise thing. You kind of have to maintain that a little bit and know what you're doing with it. But literally being able to do CPR, mouth to mouth, that sort of stuff. And then when you get into the blood and the circulation and massive wounds, there's actually a lot of ways you can take care of that stuff. You can take your own shirt off and patch it up. In a lot of ways, it's just having the bravery and the curiosity to try. Blood will congeal, and it wants to try to save itself. And if you just work with it a little bit, you can. Wouldn't hurt to have some bandages. I actually have an aid kit, one of my old, and it's really old school aid kit. I don't keep it in my vehicle anymore, but I always have kind of just a basic first aid kit. Of all the things I use, it seems it's Band-Aids more than anything, but still, handy to have. Tapes and sutures and little bigger bandages and stuff like that.
And tourniquets, those are...
Yep, and tourniquets. And realistically, you can make a tourniquet out of a lot of things. That's a little bit more skill needed there, right? Because if you put a tourniquet on where it's not needed, you could actually cause it to, kill the limb. So at least some of the training I remember is just be pretty careful with the tourniquet. But if that's the only answer, that's better than bleeding out.
Definitely. And, you hit on that bleeding out and all that. With the I'm not trying to be the doom and gloom guy, but there's all kinds of things that can happen. And what happens, you probably got taught this and everything, but with the gunshot wounds and shrapnel, there's all kinds of things that can happen when that metal enters the body. What goes on?
Yeah, you nailed it. A lot of stuff can happen. What really multiple things go on. So when we were training for the combat setting, we in the first echelon, the combat medic on the ground, our goal was to stabilize and get them out of there. Right, get them to somewhere that's sterile. Get them someplace where there's an operating room. And so we just tried to reduce the bleeding, make sure they're breathing, and get them on a bird and get them out of there, or put them in a land ambulance and get them out of there. So you know, we're the combat medic's not generally one to do the surgery or not one to get into the most complex. They're just ones to stabilize. But you know, there's a golden hour of, and really some will say it's a golden 15 minutes. If a combat medic can get to you soon enough, you're more likely to live. And so that was kind of the task at hand. And then let's get them to somebody who can do the more sophisticated stuff.
Yeah, that goes back to the whole team concept. It's like you're going to leave it in a better place, and that maybe that next person will actually save the life, and you know, they live a long, yep, healthy life. Any final thoughts on, you know, people, what should people be prepared for, or you know, appreciation for combat medics that people maybe not understand?
Yeah, I think I've hit on quite a few things. I think the most important thought of the combat medic, and at least the one that's most prevalent in my mind, is just the bravery to help, and that mentality, and how special that is. You know, if you see a combat medic, give them a hug, thank them. These are humans that have chosen to serve in some pretty tough areas, and I'd say a lot of that, you know, just soldiers in general deserve pretty similar props. It's a tough profession. It seems there's less and less of the population that takes it up, and man, they're important. The freedoms we have, you know, just they're not given away. So thankful that there's men and women out there willing to sacrifice.
Well, Judd, I thank you for joining us today on the Valor Podcast and sharing a little bit about combat medic and the nuances of that. And also thank you for serving our country and coming home and, you know, contributing to a great organization and plugging along, raising kids, all that. So,
well, thanks, man. I really appreciate it. It's been fun.
Yeah. So, you know, thanks for listening to the Valor Podcast. Make sure to like us on Facebook, and you can subscribe on iTunes and Google Play or any podcast management app. Visit our webpage at thevalorpodcast.com. That's thevalorpodcast.com. Finally, find your mission. There are many veteran organizations, nonprofits, and veterans needing your help. I promise you'll make some great friends. And go find a CPR class and learn a little bit. You may be the first on scene to an accident or somebody that's needing your help, and you can really save their life. Thanks again, and have a great week.